Welcome to the Dispatch Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Isgert, joined by David French, Steve Hayes, and Jonah Goldberg. Today, we're going to do something a little different. We are going to talk about January 6th, a year later. We're going to talk about what it was like that day. We're going to talk about what's happened in the year. And we're going to talk about how we think January 6th affects what's happening to our country going forward. So just going to be more of a freewheeling conversation, and we hope you'll come along with us. In the district. What were you doing on January 6th? Were you expecting this? Were you sort of following that there was going to be this rally?
So as you may recall, this time last year, I was making you feel incredibly envious because I was in Hawaii and sending pictures of my place, the family place in Hawaii. And I was scheduled to fly home on January 6th. And because of the top 4-hour time difference, I watched the Stop the Steal rally or most of it, and a lot of the stuff percolating up on my iPad. Basically, I remember just sort of like lying in bed watching this stuff. And I had like a 2 o'clock flight and or noon flight to LA. And I remember thinking, gosh, I'm going to have to go radio silent on the flight because there's no, Wi-Fi over that part of the Pacific. And when I land, for all I know, the Capitol will be burnt down or there will be scores of people dead, because that seemed like a reasonable expectation of how that day was going to go. And there was something very otherworldly about watching it, watching something happening in your hometown that's at the heart of your, profession, happening from a couple thousand miles away. And I remember working with Steve and David because I had a long layover at LAX to deal with our first editorial, which was on all of that stuff. And that itself was a little surreal, sitting in a waiting area trying to work on an editorial when we'd never done one before, and trying to figure out what to say. And I'm glad I did not take lead on the writing of it, because that wouldn't have worked. And and I was alone. It was just very, I got home and I was alone. My family was still in Hawaii, and it just felt like I'd come back in some ways to a different country.
Steve, you had people in the Capitol, members, staff, et cetera. Were you texting with people?
I was, yeah. I was also out of town, as it happens. And we had several reporters from the Dispatch who had gone up to the Capitol. Audrey Fahlberg and Andrew Egger wrote a terrific piece about the folks they interviewed that day and what they observed. So we were in touch with them. And, thinking back, I think that morning we were well aware of the possibility that something might go crazy. But I don't think that was my primary thought. We had conversations about sending reporters up there and said, in effect, if you don't feel safe, you should feel no obligation to go on our behalf. If you want to go, we'd love to have you. We would like to have people cover it. We'd like to have people interview the folks there. So we definitely would like to have people go, but we didn't want to push people into something. So we were aware that there was, the possibility of violence. It had been discussed. I had spoken to a couple members of Congress in advance of January 6th and in the 2, 3, 4 days beforehand, who had been briefed by the FBI. And they both said that the FBI had in effect said, we're not planning for this. Like, this is a huge deal. They had checked occupancy rates at hotels throughout the region. They didn't see anything that would suggest a massive uprising or the kind of violence that we eventually saw. Then as the day wore on, I was watching it. I was, emailing, texting with members of Congress and senators and some staff throughout the day about what they were seeing and hearing. And you know, there was that moment when things started to look like they were turning a little dark. I mean, the President Trump spoke at the rally. He said he wanted people to march peacefully toward the Capitol, but also repeatedly declared that he wanted his supporters to fight. And certainly some of the rhetoric before the actual day, before January 6th, suggested that, you know, there was at least the possibility of violence. I was on a call doing some work for the business side of the Dispatch that afternoon, a scheduled call, as things really started to turn, and was, you know, focused on the call. But, you know, out of the corner of my eye, I could see things getting a little bit ugly and getting increasingly alarmed. And that was sort of the early part of the day. The later part of the day, we can come back to it, was even more eventful in some respects.
David, what point did you turn on your TV?
I turned on, you know, at the beginning, I was not as interested in and in didn't follow the rally itself, you know, the Trump speaking part of it and all of that. I was much more interested in watching the Electoral Count Act shenanigans unfold. And so I was glued to the TV watching all of that. And so for me, it's sort of, as you're watching it, you realize that there's a lot that's happened outside before anyone inside realizes it's happened. And that was what was so surreal to me, was this slowly unfolding sense that, wait a minute, not only are they maybe going to breach the Capitol, they already did it, and they already did it some time ago, and everyone in the Capitol is only just now realizing it. And then that's when you began to see the cameras pulling back out of the Capitol, and you saw some of those, you know, the really memorable images that still sort of dominate your mind in the day of the sea of people surrounding this very thin blue line that people were just surging against. And it looked like some sort of medieval battle. And I can remember seeing that and just being furious. I mean, I was just furious. And I was furious for 19 different reasons. You know, one of them was, a lot of us had been warning this might happen.
You go through all 19.
Yeah, I'm not going to go through all 19.
First.
But I was furious. I mean, a lot of us have been warning that this would happen. And then, you know, frankly, I was pretty furious at my own tribe of, you know, evangelical conservatives, because I could see the religious fanaticism surrounding Trump rising. And, you know, you had this Jericho march in the days before January 6th. And the rhetoric there, the rhetoric was the rhetoric of religious war. And you could see immediately that religion was all over that crowd. And that was just infuriating for me to see that. And so, yeah, it was a slowly dawning realization that something worse than what we even had been warning about had occurred, and then followed by just rage, quite frankly.
So I have sort of, this will surprise no one listening who's been listening, three buckets of memories, three types of memories. One, like you, David, I was watching what was going on the floor, because you and I had done a lot of deep dives into the Electoral Count Act and the various sort of interpretive gaps that were in 3 USC 15 at that point that we were looking for answers to. Vice President had put out his sort of statement on what was going to happen, but nobody really knew what was going to happen. And we had sort of had theories. So definitely watching that unfold. And then you can just feel something's going wrong on the floor. You know, all of a sudden the vice president's disappearing. There were just like, nobody quite knew what was happening. And I remember thinking that it was an interesting failure for maybe the first time in like modern television history that the television cameras weren't really where you wanted them to be. We didn't really watch this unfold on TV. There were cameras in the well when it first was starting, and then there were cameras very outside, but then there was sort of nothing in between. You started to get some recordings on Twitter, but compared to a lot of other events that I've watched unfold in my lifetime, I mean, the Challenger explosion happened when I was quite young, but that's, you know, was being shown in classrooms across the country. you know, from that moment forward, I think we thought we would always see every single detail of everything play out on TV. The OJ car chase, you know, we'd have a helicopter in the sky. And it felt like that didn't happen on January 6th as much. And I was struck by that at the time. I had a friend, a good friend who worked for the vice president, was a senior staff member for him. And I didn't know whether he'd be with the vice president that day. And so as we were getting news reports of, you know, hang Mike Pence and they were spiriting the vice president off, I was trying to get in touch with my friend to find out, you know, is he safe? Is he there? Is he, did he stay in the office today? What's going on? He was with him. They were quite cloistered in that basement bunker that they were taken to. And they didn't really know, it seemed like, quite what was going on. You know, looking back through our texts, I will say that none of us were saying very apoplectic things to one another. You know, it was all relatively calm and, you know, finding some humor in the situation as best we could. Now, obviously, some of that's because you're worried for your friend and so you don't want to say scary things. But that was, it was hard to have friends there. Another friend, had just recently become the chief of staff for a senator. And so it was his third day on the job along with his staff, and they're barricading their doors. The staff is crying. These are, you know, young staffers. And I was, very angry when I would see people on Twitter, you know, mocking staff for crying. You know, you're sitting on Twitter, like behind your your keyboard somewhere safe at home. And it's this person's third day on the job and they don't know where the bathroom is. It took me a full 2 weeks at the Department of Justice to find the bathroom. So I'm assuming none of them knew, because everyone's like me. So that also, you know, was hard. You know, you're just sitting there on your phone trying to text people and give them sort of reports of what you're seeing on Twitter and the news. And then the third part is, I really was just sitting very 9/11-ish in my kitchen, just watching the television all day long. I just didn't turn away from it. At one point, I took a picture of Nate in front of the TV because I wanted, it felt so historic at that moment that I wanted to remember how old he was, things like that. And that was sort of as the evening wore on, and we really just, it felt like this could go either direction really quickly. And I remember Scott was working and came out of his office at one point. You know, we're all working from home still pandemic-wise. And I said, they've just breached the Capitol. And he was like, what? And that, you know, again, like just very reminiscent of 9/11 in a lot of ways. So the day ends the way that it ends, and Republicans are reacting to it in a pretty similar fashion to Democrats at the beginning. Steve, did you think that we were at a turning point in the next few days?
Yeah. I mean, I think what was somewhat apparent that day and has certainly become far more apparent and clear in the years since is that there was this divide among Republicans. Immediately you had members of the House of Representatives, Mike Gallagher, I remember, a Republican from Wisconsin, who's a friend of the Dispatch, frequently on the podcasts, recorded a video from his office saying, this is not what America is about. Donald Trump, call these people off. You had people imploring President Trump to say something. From members of Congress and the strongest, Trumpiest members of Congress to we've since learned Fox News anchors and hosts and personalities, sort of everybody normal recognized that something was really, really wrong, and that this was unacceptable. You had in that same day, in the days following, people like Kevin McCarthy blamed Donald Trump, Lindsey Graham say he tried his best to work with Donald Trump, but he was done. He was out. Lindsey Graham giving those speeches. But at the same time, and we saw, I'd say, glimpses of this, but it wasn't evident in real time the way it is now, just how much planning had gone into the other side of this. The people who were intent on actually stopping the certification and attempting to keep Donald Trump in power. And I had gotten a tip that night, the night of September 6th, that Rudy Giuliani was still making phone calls on behalf of Donald Trump to these senators to get them to slow things down. It wasn't clear exactly what they would do if things were slowed down, but they were determined not to let this actually happen. And Giuliani, I suppose sort of befitting of the clown that he had become, left a message with one senator, but intended to leave it for newly elected Senator Tommy Tuberville. And the message in effect said, we really need you. We need you to slow this down. We've got work to do. We can't let this happen. I'm calling on behalf of the president and slow this down. This was after all of the violence that we saw at the Capitol that day. This was at a time when, again, most sane Republicans, or at least temporarily sane Republicans, understood what was happening and understood that it was totally and completely unacceptable. You still had the president's team working to stop this. And, you know, certainly now that we know what was sort of underway and what they'd been working on, whether you're talking about Peter Navarro, whether you're talking about the war room set up at the Willard Hotel next to the White House with Steve Bannon and others, there was a real plan, whether John Eastman and his memos, there was a real plan to keep Donald Trump in office. And it turns out, I think, that in at least in that respect, all of the things that maybe sounded somewhat alarmist in the months after the 2020 election turned out to have been true. They were really trying to keep Donald Trump in office.
David, I don't want to jump forward, but I think it still is part of this sort of the week or so after. Have you been surprised at how serious the efforts were, knowing what we know now about what was going on in those days ahead of time and the days after, in terms of their reading of the Electoral Count Act, the Constitution, you know, all those conversations we were having ahead of time, you know, none of them involved anyone actually being able to make a good legal argument on this. I at least was very surprised reading some of these memos we've seen since then.
You know, I was surprised on two counts. And in hindsight, I only should have been surprised on one. The one count I was surprised on was one of the one that I was surprised about and is genuinely surprising in some ways is the extent to which this effort was organized politically, organized in the streets, and organized as specious as those Eastman memos are, organized legally, all directed towards a single point of pressure, and that's the Vice President of the United States. And what was sobering to me when I think about that is I'm obsessed with this question, what if Mike Pence had said yes? What if, with the pretext provided by the memos, what if with the enormous pressure being put on him by the President of the United States, by the angry base, what if he had said yes? And so I was surprised that all of these points of contact were coming at Pence. And I had kind of in my mind pictured it as, well, there's talk radio angry at Pence, and then the president is saying wild things about Pence, but the president says wild things all the time. But this effort, this Green Bay sweep, this the Eastman memos, the Jenna Ellis memos, all of this telling Mike Pence,
don't
hey,
forget
you
the
have
acting head of the Citadel Division in the Department of Justice threatening the DAG and others, the acting attorney general at that point. These were real people, Senate confirmed humans.
Yes, all telling him you have a path to a second term for Donald Trump, and it's on your shoulders. So that is the thing. Those revelations have surprised me. What also surprised me, but shouldn't have surprised me, is how quickly, immediately, the base rallied to Trump on January 6th itself. I could see it happen in real time where I was. And I think, once again, it proved that Trump was more in tune with the Republican base than Republican politicians. Here, you read Republican politicians reacting in real time, having been at the receiving end of this mob, and you could see some of that real anger and that raw anger in real time. But when people around here in Tennessee began expressing anger at the mob, the blowback they were personally experiencing instantly was unbelievable. And so you began to see some of this Republican divide that you see now, which isn't so much Trump and anti-Trump, but it's Trump and can we move on from Trump? And so, but the can we move on from Trump people, they don't want to talk about January 6th. They don't want to dwell on it. They just want to put it in the rearview mirror. And then the anti-Trump, I mean, the Trump people, of course, to the extent they're dwelling on it as how they've been treated unfairly, how they're, the January 6th rioters are political prisoners. They're dwelling on it, all right, in all of the worst ways. And then that core of that very small number of people, there's a third group of people, and unfortunately, it's the smallest, that are saying, we need to figure out what happened. We need, this is the Liz Cheney, you know, this is the faction of the very, 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 very small faction of the party that's saying, we need to put, you know, the microscope on this. This needs to never happen again. We got to figure out how this happened. And the saddest thing to me of the Republican factions, that appears to be the smallest.
Well, and we'll come back to where we are now a little bit later. But Jonah, did you think the president would get impeached?
Yes. And I think he should have been, you know, impeached much quicker, and the proceedings should have gone much quicker. I think, you know, part of the problem, this is the problem you get with so much of the Trump stuff. I mean, it's the January 6th thing was a, I don't want to say it was a microcosm because it was such a macro event, but it was sort of the, all of the themes of 4 years of Trumpism were in some ways played out because of January and within and because of January 6th, in the sense that Trump learned, you know, that shoot him on Fifth Avenue thing, which, you know, first was sort of this sort of dumb throwaway line, over time became sort of this real dynamic where he could do unthinkable or indefensible things. And then immediately, like an antibody response, the right wing base, the infotainment structure in certain parts of sort of Fox and talk radio world and that kind of thing went to work to whataboutist, you know, to what about it to say, well, actually, and figure out a way to say, no, this indefensible thing is not only defensible, we should own it and be proud of it. And the rapidity of that happening on January 6th, I think, is one of the most dismaying and the most shocking things about it. It was like the process started, as David was saying, almost immediately. One last point is that if you just take a step back for a second, like, I keep thinking about, like, John McCain, you know, he was involved in the Keating Five thing and it plagued him for the rest of his life because he could never sort of, he was like, you know, the stain on his reputation was such that he could never speak about his honor and integrity without first admitting how he screwed up something. You know, there are these mistakes you make in life that for the rest of your life, you always have to say, well, except for this one time where I did X, you know, that kind of thing. For the rest of American history, whether this republic lasts another century or five centuries or 5,000 centuries, we can no longer brag about the peaceful transfer of power anymore the way we did prior to 2020. That is a huge deal, and it happened on purpose. And these people who did this, either deliberately in some cases, or with other disregard if this was a possibility, set in play a bunch of things in an attempt to steal an election that would have ruined, if successful, our ability to lecture other countries around the world about democracy and the peaceful transfer of power, about being able to tell our kids about this is one of the great things about this country. And the fact that so many people instantaneously treated the event as if the thing that's outrageous about January 6th is the big deal its critics are making out of it.
Right.
is something that I don't think the damage that's done to the culture by all of this and to the psyche of American politics and the American right has come close to being appreciated.
But do you think, let me just push you on that. Do you think it really was instantaneously? I mean, I think there was this split. We saw sort of hints of it in those early days. But I mean, Kevin McCarthy a week later gave a speech condemning Donald Trump on the floor of the House of Representatives. You had all of these people who had been, you know, I would say Trump water carriers who we can quibble over what an extended period of time is, but longer than a blink of an eye, who sort of recognized what any sane person would have recognized, which was that, holy cow, this is awful. This is really, really terrible. And then gradually, I mean, maybe this doesn't matter because eventually they got there. But to me, it's more damning of them in a certain sense because they recognized not just in the moment that it was wrong, but for a while that it was wrong. Now, they didn't vote to impeach him, everybody but 10 of those Republicans, all but a handful of senators didn't vote to convict him. But there was this, you know, at least for a week, there was this sense that, wow, something unprecedented has happened here. And it was really, really wrong. And it was only later in January that Kevin McCarthy took a secret trip down to Mar-a-Lago.
I agree with all of that. But my point, and that was the point a bunch of us made about the Laura and Hannity texts to Mark Meadows, is that they revealed themselves of actually being in the closet, decent people who understood the gravity of what was going on. But they just,
these are the Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity texts to Mark Meadows
saying, stop
the
this
January
right now.
6th
right.
committee has uncovered. Yeah.
They recognize that Donald Trump was responsible for this stuff and that he had the power to stop it. They just really were reluctant to say so on air even that night. And that's what I'm sort of talking about. Yeah, I agree. It was my point wasn't that they didn't recognize how bad it was. And it wasn't that they all instantly started backpedaling. It's that process started almost instantaneously. And then it applied to, and you know, it's like some character like Deadpool or somebody in a movie who has a fast healing ability, like a terrible wound. It takes a little while for the wound to like suddenly self heal. But like that process of the right grabbing their mops and buckets and hammers and nails to fix this problem started so unbelievably quickly. And and I agree with you entirely. What is damning about the initial response from virtually everybody, either publicly or privately or both, is that it reveals these people could be snapped out of the cult of personality worship stuff. They could see the event for what it was, but they could not hold on to their decency and their realism for very long in the face of the need to return to the narrative of Donald Trump being in the right and the real villains were the other people. And now that process is largely complete. I mean, it's more than complete. And it's very Alinskyite. You know, they take something that is a problem for our side, quote unquote, our side, and try to turn it into a positive. And that's what Tucker's doing by saying, no, the heroes, whatever. Like American Greatness just had this absolute garbage piece saying, so long as the left is saying this is like a Reichstag fire, we need to say this is like our Bastille Day and defend all of this.
And when has the right ever embraced the French Revolution?
Right.
The American right.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is the second half of our podcast where we're going to have disagreement. So for the first half, we've all agreed what happened on January 6th. We've all discussed various parts of those hours and days after. But now for the second half, where there's maybe three parts I want to break this into. The first is to challenge what you're saying a little bit, Jonah, because, well, Jonah and Steve, both of you are putting this fully in only the context of the right. And David, I want to bring you into this, but we're also forgetting the left. So there's a reason that it takes so long for Donald Trump to be, for the articles of impeachment to be drafted and brought forward. Nancy Pelosi didn't do it a day later or 2 days later. What, it took 2 weeks, David? Like right before he was going out of office? Why is that? Because the timing would then be that much harder for Republicans to deal with. She didn't involve Republicans in the drafting of it. It was about incitement, not about dereliction of duty. The article went back to October, as in pre-election, so that any Republicans who signed on to it would have to be signing on to the idea that Donald Trump's impeachable incitement action happened during the campaign where they were supporting Donald Trump, which was it just like intellectually untenable, even also politically untenable. So immediately you're talking about how the right got their mop and buckets out, but on the left, they wanted this to be tribalism also. And so I think only talking about this in terms of, you know, right-wing talk radio and Hannity or Fox News misses a whole other side of what was going on here. If everyone thinks this is a political moment, then how can you possibly be surprised that it became tribal on the right when it was already tribal on the left? David, please respond.
I mean, okay. Nancy Pelosi did some procedural things in response to an attempted coup on the United States government.
But isn't that David? What? Like, exactly. There was a attack on the Capitol.
I know. And Nancy Pelosi did not handle it perfectly. Correct.
Not just not perfectly. But, she refused to involve Republicans.
Sarah. The night of January 6th, 147 Republicans voted, to scrap some of the election results. Eight senators, 139 representatives. You know, so
that leaves roughly
80
who were able to work with Nancy Pelosi to draft an article of impeachment.
Fine. That would have been plenty. I stipulate it. She didn't do a good job. Okay, she didn't
do
a good job.
It's not that she didn't do a good job, it's that she wanted, there was as much political tribalism on the left in the hours and days later.
Nope. So the thing is, what we had was the head of the Republican Party, in assistance, assisted by a majority of the Republican House, tried to overthrow our government, okay? Nancy Pelosi comes in, and I will stipulate that the way she responded to impeachment was too slow and too partisan. That's normal bad, okay? That's normal bad. It doesn't even belong in the conversation.
But what about the Democrats who had objected to, I mean, why are you saying that they tried to overthrow the government when there have been representatives who have voted against certifying electoral slates before? They weren't trying to overthrow the government.
Well, again, what we're talking about is, so that's beyond normal bad, trying to not certify, say, George W. Bush's election. That's beyond normal bad. It was such a small effort. It was fortunately irrelevant. This one resulted in the capture of the violent seizure of the Capitol and was supported by the President of the United States, where only the vice president rejecting the president and senior leaders of the president's administration saved us from the possible collapse of the United States of America.
I obviously accept all of that, but then treating it, to me, it's a little like the filibuster, right? Both sides can claim that the other side got rid of the filibuster because it's been incremental. We've been frogs in a pot of boiling water when it comes to the filibuster. We have for the undermining of our election norms as well. And that's why—
But this was such a giant leap forward.
I don't think it was a giant leap forward. I think it was a leap forward for sure. I think it was Harry Reid saying we weren't going to have the filibuster.
January 6th. I think incremental getting rid of the filibuster for Gorsuch.
In the days after Donald Trump was inaugurated, was it his inauguration or his election? When Antifa terrorists went through DC and burned K Street down and broke all the windows? You don't think that was maybe a first step towards this?
Oh, that was terrible. That was horrible.
How is that not similar to this? again, this was a leap, but I don't think it's like that wildly like, oh my God, like it, this is step by step by step. Each time, each side
there's
is
a
willing
giant
to go
difference
to new
between
lengths.
Obama, between Antifa or the Proud Boys and the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters and the First Amendment Praetorian, supported by the sitting president of the United States of America in the effort to overturn an election result. That's an order of magnitude difference, Sarah. It's a giant order of magnitude difference than a street gang rioting, street gang supported by the president of the United States with a majority of his elected representatives in the House continuing to support the effort to overturn the election after the Capitol was violently attacked. And I'm going to stipulate to everything you critique about Nancy Pelosi, it's just not in, it's not just not in the
so
same
you
ballpark.
Think this is,
it's not in the same county of the same ballpark.
Look, and Steve and Jonah, about to bring you in. I agree that it is a huge difference. I do not want to minimize it. I hope I've made that clear. My point is that saying that this is a right-wing only problem is going to be proven factually incorrect in a perhaps terrifying way, Jonah, if we don't see this as a larger American problem and continue to say, nope, it's the right wing, it's the conservative media, it's just Republicans. No.
But who's just specifically, who is saying that? I mean, nobody on this podcast is saying that. Is it your claim that others are saying this is only a right-wing problem?
I think that y'all have not been giving enough broader picture to the fact that this can happen on both sides and that this has been Republicans' fault. January 6th.
I am much more in your camp than I think you realize in the sense that, you know, I've been writing about this. I mentioned this on Meet the Press on Sunday. Like, I think January 6th exposed a across the board elite failure. The way Nancy Pelosi handled impeachment was bad. It was a sign that she doesn't see herself as representing an institution. She sees herself as representing the partisan faction that for the time being controls the institution. That's
I
all
also
bad.
Think I, it was a sign that she didn't think January 6th was very serious.
I think that I don't think that's right. I think that what it was a sign was like they thought, this is such an unbelievable, wonderful political weapon. Let's use it to our advantage. But it didn't mean they weren't legitimately horrified by it. And I think the problem that you're running into here is that, first of all, there are differences of degree that become differences in kind. An assault on the seat of government, where people are literally chanting, hang the vice president if he doesn't willingly go along with a premeditated plan to steal an election.
Yes, yes, I'll stipulate it.
It's different,
right?
I mean, as Kevin Williamson says, a riot that is part of a coup d'etat is a lot different than a riot that is part of a coup d'etat. And I think that the part of the problem with your analogy here is that whereas I agree that the Antifa stuff was terrible, the forgiveness for the violence from the left was terrible and all these kinds of things, this was a premeditated plan by the president of the United States and his minions.
Totally, yes. My point is it's a step along the way. Yes, this was a bad step. Maybe it was even a difference in kind of a step. But we're acting like it's the end. It's not.
But the thing is,
we're not acting like it's the end.
When you're, and I agree that it is part of a process of the erosion of leadership within this country on a whole bunch of fronts, but it is orders of magnitude just simply a different kind of crime than the collective action problems we've seen in the past because it was deliberate. And I have no problem with people making your argument, but one of the reasons why the right is such the hot mess and deserves the crap that that David, Steve, and I are giving it is that they only give the part of the argument that you're giving about how Nancy Pelosi is bad. I mean,
it's
Kevin
true.
McCarthy's position right now.
It's totally
is,
true.
He gave a statement on Sunday where he said, the central question of January 6th, the central question, ladies and gentlemen, is why did Nancy Pelosi leave the house unprepared for this event.
Yeah, that's silliness.
And this is like ordering, it's like swatting someone's house where I fraudulently call a police report, say, you got to go to David French's house. He's holding hostages. He's got guns. And then saying the real scandal is that David was not prepared for the SWAT attack. And so I have no problem with you. I make a lot of these points that you're making all the time, Sarah, about the how the left has dropped the ball on a lot of this as well. And they should have made Liz Cheney an impeachment manager. They should have worked with Republicans to write the articles on impeachment. I've said that on 30 different podcasts now. But unless someone is willing to say, first, and which you are, you have to first be willing to stipulate that what Donald Trump did was a disqualifying, outrageous, arguably treasonous, evil crime where he instigated a mob as part of a larger plan to steal an election, and that it should bar him from public office for the rest of his life. Unless you're willing to say those things and then say, and by the way, Nancy Pelosi didn't do a really good job either.
My point is that January 6th didn't come out of nowhere. It didn't just, a spring from the foam, and that we are heading toward the same thing in 2024, and it could be from either side. And so the more we simply focus as a culture, as a punditry, on only the right, we've got a problem. Steve,
The right refuses to condemn it, the easier it is going to be for the left to say, well, you didn't condemn it when your side did it. It's all the more reason it's the responsibility of the right to condemn it.
Yes, I would like to condemn all of it is the issue. Steve, we haven't talked a lot about the January 6th committee, and I want to make sure we do. What do you view as the purpose of the committee?
Yeah, I will answer your question. I always answer your question.
But before that,
just my two cents. I agree with you. I agree with a lot of what you said. In fact, I think if you listen to these podcasts of 51 weeks ago, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I was doing some real-time reporting on Nancy Pelosi's decision not to include Republicans and condemned that in the strongest possible way. I was talking to probably a couple dozen members of Congress at the time, Republicans, who were willing to work with Democrats on the impeachment language. She did the same thing on the January 6th commission, made it entirely partisan, announced her plans for it without consulting Republicans, including Liz Cheney, who was then in Republican leadership.
It's just hard to imagine post 9/11 saying we don't need to include Democrats in our resolution condemning 9/11 and then saying, but we take 9/11 seriously. No, obviously you don't take it seriously if you are seeing this through a partisan only lens.
I mean, so many of the people in Washington, the people who are elected members of Congress.
9/11 would have been different if the towers were attacked by the head of the attack was directed by the head of the Republican Party. That would have been a less bipartisan response.
I think if you look at her partisanship, I don't think it necessarily means she didn't think that this was a serious attack. I think she probably did think it was a serious attack. I would argue that because she thought it was a serious attack, that makes it even more outrageous that she was willing to politicize it. She shouldn't have. And she did. And she deserves condemnation for that. But I just think it isn't just a matter of difference of degree. It's a difference in kind. I mean, we're not talking about an apples to apples comparison here, or even an apples to steaks comparison here. We're talking about like apples to sheet metal. Like, these are not the same things at all. They have nothing to do with one another. And so I just think
Well, they do for me in the sense that each side is creating the churn that makes the other side more tribal. The actions by the Republicans to not certify the election made the Democrats more tribal. The actions by Nancy Pelosi to treat this as a partisan event made the Republicans more tribal. And so it's a tit for tat all the way down the line, and it leads to something really bad. And the more we simply focus on the right's actions on January 6th, we're missing where this is headed.
No, I agree. Look, I share your concern about where it's headed. I guess I would just say that if we're looking at what happened and you're looking at it in the context of January 6th, you know, as David says, you have Nancy Pelosi committing some procedural fouls mistakes, misjudgments, and Donald Trump trying to forcibly remain in office. Like, these just are not in the same universe at all.
I guess I disagree that they were procedural mistakes. I think Donald Trump could have been impeached and potentially convicted in the Senate if Nancy Pelosi had not been the Speaker of the House.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that.
So that is not a procedural mistake.
No, I don't agree with that at all.
I think he could have been impeached. I think there was a moment, I mean, I know there was a moment where Mitch McConnell was very open to convicting
Donald
Trump.
If she wanted him convicted, she needed to have the article of impeachment done the next day, and she knew it.
Yeah, and they could have had more Republicans in the House, which would have built momentum, and I think could have had him impeached and removed. I really believe that's true.
And so it's not a procedural mistake. That's, it changed the course of the country's history.
That is a procedural mistake. I'm not saying it doesn't have big consequences, but even if I stipulate to the seriousness of the procedural mistake, the argument that you're making, it is not stopping the peaceful transfer of power and trying to remain in office based on lies about an election.
Yeah, like it's not. They're just. They're still not the same. They're still not the same. What I'm saying is, it's this continual churn that each side eggs the other on. And again, the more we focus on just one side on one day and that huge leap, difference in kind and sheet metal that it was, you miss the bigger picture.
Fair
and I think
enough.
Historians
will
look back and think we were insane to only care about January 6th and not see the water temperature rising around us.
If you look at, I mean, my gosh, ever since, but both before and after January 6th, the amount of people who are weighing in on the possibility of civil war in the United States is...
But they think it's going to be driven by the right.
But look, I just want to be clear. Like, it's when you say you can't focus on just the right, we are not doing that. Like, I know that's not what you're suggesting,
but I
want to be clear for listeners. We are not doing that. And as I say, I believe in the podcast that we did immediately after January 6th, we talked about what Nancy Pelosi was doing. So I think we have looked at both sides of this, even if, in my view, there's no comparison between the two. Okay, so now to your actual question, to the January 6th committee. So best case scenario, unfortunately, I think, you know, to your previous point, Nancy Pelosi made what could have been a more productive, more bipartisan effort, less bipartisan she sent out a letter announcing what the committee was going to look like without consulting Republicans. And as I say, Liz Cheney was at the time the number three Republican in the House of Representatives. She was making these arguments behind the scenes. I believe she had a reasonable expectation that some, a minority, but a sizable minority of Republicans were sympathetic to the arguments she was making and would have gone along. Nancy Pelosi screwed that all up. She screwed it all up on impeachment. She screwed it all up on the committee. So I think the best case scenario would have been a committee that produces a report, something like the 9/11 Commission report, which was deeply, deeply flawed in many, many ways. I went through it carefully at the time. I won't bother to go through all the details of the mistakes right now. But it was a flawed package. But what it gave us was, based on real-time documentation, interviews with participants, sort of in the immediate aftermath of the event, it gave us a reasonable approximation of what happened, of that history, even if there were some details that I think they didn't get quite right. The best case scenario would have been for that to happen from this. And I don't think we're not going to have a report out of this committee that Kevin McCarthy says, they make some interesting points. They found some interesting things. We should consider this and, talk together about how to move forward. Republicans have decided that it's a partisan committee. The Republican commentariat, including many people who strongly condemned Donald Trump and expressed serious concerns about January 6th, have swung entirely against the committee for reasons that aren't really clear, other than that they are back on the team and they're wearing red jerseys. Where I do think it can be useful is to the extent that it's able to get its hands on these documents that give us insights as to what was happening both on that afternoon, documents and or transcribed interviews, what have you, that give us a better sense of exactly what happened that afternoon. I mean, we now know, for instance, much more than we did a year ago about what Donald Trump was doing. It was clear that he was watching television, that he was enthusiastic about what was happening. We had those reports in the media in the immediate aftermath of January 6th, but we now know with much greater detail and from eyewitnesses what he was doing and what he wasn't doing. We have, you know, contemporaneous texts from senior White House officials to a wide variety of people, including, you know, our former colleagues at Fox News. I mean, there have been, as Jonah mentioned earlier, there have been revelations about what people like Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham were saying in public that in some ways it was consistent with what they were saying in private. They were showing alarm. In other ways, they were totally changing the story and doing Donald Trump's bidding, which, you know, that fact isn't surprising. To see it in their own words is somewhat surprising. There's a new text from Sean Hannity yesterday, revealed yesterday by the committee, that showed Hannity saying he was worried. This is on January 5th. He was worried about what was going to happen over the next 48 hours. And that same day, Hannity goes on air and says, you know, big day, lots of people coming, you know, sort of celebrating what was going to happen. That doesn't have tremendous bearing on actual, you know, planning for January 6th, what have you. But it does give us more information about who is doing and who was saying what. And while Hannity, you could sort of write him off as just a media personality, very clear that he was intimately involved in the PR response and all of this from the beginning. So I think giving us that kind of real-time understanding of what was happening will be helpful.
David, what is the, well, we haven't heard from Jonah, perhaps. Jonah, thinking about the committee's work, what is the role of the Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger on the committee, and how should we think about, you know, this being really still partisan, even with them on it? You know, some of the, I think, objection that Republicans are making to this committee's work is that it is meant to be basically a campaign prop for the D-trip heading into the midterms. And whose role is it to, quote, punish Republicans? Is it this committee or is it the voters in their districts?
Or the courts, right? I mean, like, there's also, like, the Congress is not a criminal investigative body and all it can do is refer stuff to the DOJ. And it seems to be acting a little bit like a grand jury and a little bit like a partisan thing. I think, you know, Kevin McCarthy's decision to refuse to appoint anybody to the committee is feeling more and more like the Soviets' decision to walk out of the UN in advance of the vote to go to war in Korea, in the sense that it seemed like this, oh, let's show these guys act of defiance. And it turned out to be incredibly dumb because you could have people far more, I mean, this is, you know, best gas station sushi in Alabama kind of standard, but you can have people more responsible than Jim Jordan on that committee who would still bring up legitimate concerns about, you know, the partisan nature of this or the precedent of that, that could slow this thing down. And but Kevin McCarthy thought he was making a smart play by keeping any loyal, you know, team player, quasi pro Trump Republicans off the committee. And so the committee has just basically a totally free hand to do whatever it wants, which is, I think was a politically boneheaded move. But I honestly, I don't care at this point, because at the end of the day, getting these facts into the historical record, even if they don't turn out to be the partisan weapon that they want them to be, it feels like the Democrats are trying to make January 6th a political cause for the midterms, that in the same way that Terry McAuliffe tried to make Donald Trump the central part of his Virginia gubernatorial bid. And it feels like bad politics, even if I'm sympathetic to the outrage. And so I want this stuff on record. I want this to be known. I want this to be locked in the history books. And if this is the way you do that, I don't care about the political consequences of it. I think that getting to the truth of this whole thing is vastly more important. And I will say, just because I think it is one of the funniest things to watch, is people like Peter Navarro patiently, calmly going on TV yeah. and confessing to a crime is just so joyful to watch and helpful. But I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see more people just sort of going out there and not, and having spent so long in the bunker bragging about their role of being part of an effort to steal an election, don't realize that you're not supposed to say that out loud in mixed company. And I'd like to see a lot more of that. And I'd like to look, I want to see some at least historical accountability for Sean Hannity and Tucker and all these people. I think it's useful to get this stuff out there, even if it's not the political silver bullet that the Democrats think it's going to be.
David, we're heading into 2022, 2024. Nothing has changed. None of the basics have changed. What should we be doing differently?
Boy, that is that's a really good question. You know, look, I think one of the things, and I was just talking to somebody the other day who was asking me, what does a post-Trump future on the right look like? And I said, if you're waiting for people to sort of suddenly say, you know what, our bad for supporting Trump, you're going to be waiting a really, really, really long time. The future, I think, looks like people moving on if it's going to be a positive future. More like the Glenn Youngkin race, where he sort of holds down the right, finesses that the questions around the election, and then forges forward, presenting a particular vision that really has nothing to do with much to do with Trumpism at all. A kind of a turn the page. And part of the ways that, like, Ronald Reagan, for example, turned the page from the Nixon era. So I think there's a vision of a better Republican Party that is not going to be what that can be a lot better and can be a positive and can be a positive presence in the American life that is not still not going to be what a lot of people want, which is sort of this come to Jesus moment that says we shouldn't have gone down the Trump road. We shouldn't have done that. We shouldn't have defended him. So I do think there is a future that is a better vision, but it's a vision of moving on, not of repudiation, if that makes sense. But right now, Sarah, goodness, I wrote a whole book about how there isn't a single truly important social, cultural, political, or religious dynamic that is pulling these United States together more than it's pushing us apart. And to me, the central challenge we have going forward is not only is that still true, it's more true than it was before January 6th, that the forces pushing each other, pushing us apart from each other, are stronger. And that is, I think, the central challenge, of which politics, quite frankly, is just one part of it, and not even necessarily the most important part. It's downstream from a lot of these cultural indicators of the big sort, and increasing cultural differences, a decreasing appreciation for tolerance and grace, a decreasing number of close friendships. I've written about this as a factor, as something that's really harming our culture, where we're replacing the connection of civic association and friendships with something more hollow and artificial, and political associations and political causes. So I think that's our central challenge. It isn't what's going to happen to the Republican Party. The Republican Party will be, what happens to the Republican Party will be downstream of that. We still have the challenge that there is not a single truly important cultural, religious, social force that is pulling us together more than it's pushing us apart.
Yeah. And I mean, as I've said before, I think that if you have a Biden versus Trump rematch in 2024, both sides believe that the other side is trying to take the election. Democrats absolutely believe that Republicans at the state level are trying to change the rules so that they can steal the election. Republicans believe that that's what Democrats did with COVID changes to the election in 2020. And it's a recipe for, I think, a much bigger disaster than we saw on January 6th. All right. Last quick thoughts. Steve, in 20 years, what will we be saying differently about January 6th than we're saying this week?
Yeah, that's a great question. I hope and expect that through this discovery process that the January 6th committee is doing, we will get a lot more of this kind of real-time understanding of what was happening. The committee has cooperation of many, many Trump White House officials, including cabinet level officials and people who were in the building, involved in these discussions, who were at the time and remain appalled by everything that they were seeing. Many of those people are cooperating. So while I would love to see somebody like Mark Meadows, who seems to be at the center of all this, suddenly decide that he owes it to history and to the capital T truth to talk about what was happening and to share his recollections, I don't expect that we'll do that. But I do think that given the cooperation of so many other people around, it will be a rather definitive report. And I think we'll understand. I mean, to me, the biggest takeaway, if you go back to the day of January 6th, 2021, what we saw happening looked like it could have been, a protest or a riot spun out of control with, the most fervent Trump supporters storming the Capitol in kind of a spontaneous show of frustration about what happened. And I think that that description applies to many, if not most, of the people who were there. I don't think that most of the people who stormed the Capitol were part of a Steve Bannon-driven conspiracy or Donald Trump-driven conspiracy to keep Trump in office. However, it is now clear beyond any dispute that there was a Steve Bannon conspiracy, a Donald Trump conspiracy to keep Trump in power. That's what this was about. It was about pressuring Mike Pence behind the scenes initially, and then pressuring him publicly to do the wrong thing, to unilaterally declare that Donald Trump could remain president and kick this to state legislatures. This was a plan. It was an obvious plan, and it's appalling. And I guess the great sort of the thing that worries me most, if we're even having these conversations in 20 years, is that the people who saw this, even with imperfect information in January 6th, and understood that what was happening was profoundly wrong and un-American, now with the benefit of all of this additional information and information that makes clear that Donald Trump tried to stay in office and steal an election, have returned to Trump's side. Amazing to me.
Jonah, let's see if you can do a better job. Quickly, short answer. What will historians say in 20 years about January 6th that we're not saying now?
I think over time, the truth of it will, the discussion of it will get closer to the truth of it, which means that the significance of the actual mobsters will decrease. Because the primary thing to know about most of those people who were committing violence, breaking windows, defecating in the hallways, all that kind of stuff. For the most part, it's not that they were fascists or white supremacists, though I'm sure there were some of both in the mix. The salient point is that they were idiots. They were profoundly stupid, gullible people who were misled by the President of the United States and his sort of infotainment enablers. And so I think in some ways, as much as I love heaping scorn on Peter Navarro, I think his narrative is going to be closer to how we're going to talk about it in the future, which is that they had a plan to steal the election that didn't involve violence. But because they were so stupid and so bad at figuring out how to do this, they did not anticipate the foreseeable violence that would come from the rhetoric and the actions that they took. And it seems to me that at the end of the day, egging on a crowd that went violent, as negligent and as evil as that really was, the greater crime was trying to steal an election and doing it with premeditation and considerable planning beforehand. And I think in history, that is where the emphasis will be put, is on the effort to steal the election and look at, and then the downstream problems that trying to implement that plan caused, including the violence of January 6th.
David, I don't know if anyone knows what short answer means. Let's see if you do.
I will say with this qualifier, if present trends continue, I think in a generation or so, people will look back on January 6th as one of the most significant markers of deep and profound and what should have been quite obvious to us in the moment, cultural instability and political instability in the United States, that we were in the process of failure as a nation. And that the unwillingness of a critical mass of Americans to wake up to that as a salient reality above and beyond the daily realities of our lives may well be looked back on by future generations as a fatal mistake for our country.
I think those were all good answers. All right. Thank you guys for tuning in to this a little bit unusual New Year's podcast that we're doing, and we'll get back to our regular schedule, if you will, next week. Bye, guys.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.